Okay, thank you for the nice introduction. So today I'll tell you about some work which we've been doing for a couple of years by now. So the work which I'll describe is published in these papers. The first one is the PRL in 2005 is the paper when we first started working on this and predicted the Pfaffian state of PUA Fischbach resonances, which was our motivation. I'll explain as I go what I mean by this. And then the second paper is a sort of review-ish, a long paper where we pretty much wrote everything we know about P-wave and also about narrow resonance S-wave, PCS-BEC crossover. And finally, the third paper is the paper which describes work we've done during this workshop, which analyzes the stability of P-wave condenses, which seems to be a big issue and the reason why experiments have not yet been done on these P-wave systems. So first, let me tell you why you want to study P-wave Fischbach resonances and P-wave superfluids. Well, one point of view is that people have been doing S-wave, so why wouldn't we do P-wave? Because it's just the next letter of the alphabet, and then we can go to D-wave, F-wave.
And special.
It's not exactly the alphabet, but you know what I mean. So that definitely was the motivation of some of the papers which came out about the same time as our paper, but our motivation was slightly different. First of all, we observed that the S-wave Fischbach resonance experiments, they were done by two species of atoms, so that atoms of different species would interact via S-wave interactions. If you now take only single species of atoms, which in this atomic physics is very easy to do, all atoms are in the same hyperfine state, then these guys will be identical fermions, and I'm only talking about fermionic atoms in this talk.
And so different species are not really different atoms, it's just different states.
Different states of the same atom. But now you might as well just take atoms in the same state, and then they'll interact in the P-wave. So P-wave are easy to achieve. And I mean, they'll also interact on all other odd waves, but each next wave is weaker than the previous one. So by taking the same species, you suppress S wave, and now you're left with P wave. So I'll write here motivation. And the first would be identical fermions. They automatically P wave. They only interact in beginning from the P-wave channel, and there's no S-wave interaction. So that's one reason. Then the second reason is that, as I'll discuss today, unlike the S-wave BCS-BEC crossover, when you have P-wave atoms with attractive interactions, they go through a phase transition. BCS and BEC are two different phases separated by a phase transition. So the second motivation would be that BCS to BEC is a phase transition. And as we've discovered, for atomic physicists, it might not make much difference whether there's a phase transition or crossover between BCS and BEC. But in condensed matter physics, typically we like phase transitions more because we sort of can understand better what's going on. While in the crossover, it's just a matter of numbers which are changing as you're going through the crossover. So that was the second motivation, to understand how you get this transition. And the third one, which was the most exotic and the most exciting, actually, the whole motivation of us getting into this field, is that if you confine these fermions to 2D, so you have to confine these guys to two-dimensional space, which is easy to do in these experiments, apparently, by slicing your condensate with lasers. So then there is one of the two possible phases which these identical fermions can form will be topological, namely the PX plus IPY phase. So, in fact, as I'll explain, in this BCS-BEC phase transition situation, there are always two competing phases in both BCS and BEC. One of them is termed PX plus IPY, and the other is PX. And one of them is not topological in 3D or 2D. The other is topological in 2D. It's PX plus IPY phase. It is equivalent to a quantum Hall state, famous Pfaffian or Moore-Reed state, which is postulated for the 5-half plateau of quantum Hall effect. And in particular, it has excitations which are based on abelian statistics, and it's been proposed to use this kind of excitations for quantum computation, although the specific excitations which occur in this Fafian PX plus IPY phase are known not to give universal quantum computation. But, you know, to me, even demonstration of non-universal quantum computation would be a big progress over where we are right now. So this is a major motivation of trying to study this P-wave condenses. And so one of the results of our first paper was that these guys, they naturally want to be PX plus IPY. So even though it's a competition between PX plus IPY and PX phase generally loses. And that was great. So when we first started working on it, this is what we hoped for, or at least we hope that this at least would, you know, make this work more interesting, the fact that you can get topological phase as opposed to more boring standard phase. And this is what came out of the calculation. These guys want to be PX plus IPY. So because of it, it's a third and I would say most exotic and most interesting reason to study P-wave. And, you know, if these guys ever do experiments, then perhaps this will be the path to create these topological states. Now, what is the experimental situation? P-wave Fischbach resonances in identical fermions was studied twice in 2004 and 2007 in Christoph Salomon group in lithium-6 and in David Jin's group in potassium-40. And both times, they discovered that the P-wave molecules are unstable. If you create this P-wave molecule, you wait for a couple of milliseconds. It's a matter of a few milliseconds. And these guys just disappear. Which, well, in the experiment, they cannot tell what exactly happens. Presumably, they fly away, or they collapse, or something else happens. And so the third paper on this list studies the origin of what may go wrong, why these guys have this tendency of disappearing, and what can we do to fight it. And so the conclusion is that in three dimensions, and all the experiments were done in three-dimensional space, there is indeed some instability going on there, which will perhaps prevent us from observing the P-wave BCS and BEC phases, although some estimates show that there is still some room, perhaps, of observing it. But at least there is no parametrically small parameter which prevents these things from happening. It's more a matter of numbers. But then, just as we submitted this paper, which, as you can see, it's a very recent paper, it's late May, we've realized that if you now confine these guys in 2D, stability increases significantly. And perhaps even in 2D, these P-wave condenses are achievable. Now, this is work in progress. We only have right now an estimate, which requires additional calculations, so hasn't yet been published. But we're hopeful right now. So in 2D, perhaps, these guys are stable. But, well, you have to wait and see what comes out. Maybe they're not. But if they are stable, then the whole program is justified. So all the experimentalists need to do is to confine these guys to 2D.
Why would the system be stable?
Well, that's what I plan to talk about. And let me just get to the point where I'll talk about stability, and then I'll explain why in 2D it's more stable. So first, let me describe for you what was done in the very first work in 2005, namely, how to study these P-wave resonances, what kind of condenses they lead to, and most importantly, why these guys are PX plus IPY and not just PX. So P-wave condenses are studied with the two-channel model, which is, well, it's a standard generalization of S-wave two-channel model, which appeared in this workshop a few times. So you have fermions, this time identical fermions without spin, with some kinetic energy. Now, those guys can form molecules whose mass is twice as high, so they have mass twice m, plus some detuning, bq dagger bq. So detuning tells us that if molecule forms, its ground state energy, or it's the energy of the molecule which does not move, is epsilon naught when counted from the energy of an atom which doesn't move. And finally, these guys can underconvert. So there is an underconversion term. So on the surface of things, oh, and I forgot the most important thing. This is S-wave. I didn't actually put in P-wave, so let me put P-wave. What P-wave means is that the molecules themselves have angular momentum 1, so they are rotating. you know, the way I wrote it right now, this guy is actually zero because there's no S wave interactions between identical fermions. So because they're rotating, they have an index. The angular momentum which we'll be studying will be one. So two fermions collide. They collide in the angular momentum one channel. Angular momentum one is easiest to describe as a vector. So we're going to put an extra vector index here, mu, next to the boson, bosonic molecule. It's a polarization of this molecule. And it couples to the relative momentum of the pair, which forms and turns the molecule, p mu. So, and mu here is, again, a three-dimensional vector index. So this is the model.
So fermions do not have this index, right?
Fermions don't have this index. So fermions are completely featureless point particles. Bosons, we think of them as molecule with angular momentum 1, and so they need to have this index.
So, no additional p dependence to this interaction, this conversion of
here? Yeah, so in principle, at large momenta, you need to introduce some additional p dependence. So this can only work at small momenta. And, well, the reason this is p mu, that you can interpret this p mu as a Fourier transform of the molecular wave function. So if you actually took a step back and thought about what happens when two fermions form a wave function, I mean, they form a bound state, which is this b, then the guy which you need to put here is a Fourier transform of that wave function, and now the angular momentum one wave function has a Fourier transform, which at low momentum goes linearly with momentum and proportional to p mu. This is the property of spherical harmonics. But in principle, at larger momenta, of the momentum of the order of the size of that guy, there will be some factor here, p dependent, which actually at very high p will drop to zero, to signify the fact that fermions with extraordinary high momentum will not form a molecule because they overlap with the finite size wave function at zero. And we will encode this by saying that all momenta in the sum are restricted by some highest momentum lambda, which is the cutoff of my theory. Typically, people also introduce the length Re, which is the range of the forces, the van der Waals forces, which created this molecule in the first place. It's known to be about 50 angstrom. And so this lambda in the units where h bar is 1, it's 1 over lambda. Re is one over lambda. So this is the highest momentum is the inverse physical size of these molecules as they form, or the range of the forces which led to the formation of the molecules.
But again, p mu is different from just p.
P mu is the mu's component. Mu is x, y, and z.
Okay.
So mu is a vector index, and b mu also has a vector index, x, y, and z. And I'm summing here over mu. Okay. So of course, we could just write this Hamiltonian and start studying it, but what we realized is that in order to make sense out of problems like this, it first makes sense to understand what this means from the point of view of fermions. So this Hamiltonian is a way of describing how fermions interact, and although we can say these words, that they glue together to form a molecule with energy epsilon naught, it is instructive to look at the scattering of two fermions, which tells us, for example, whether they are trying to form a bound state or they are scattering in some kind of resonant fashion. So let's do it. The scattering of two fermions is described by the process where two fermions come in with momentum p and minus p, form a molecule, and then the molecule can virtually polarize into fermions, and eventually fermions fly out. So this can be, all that diagrams of this sort can be summed up and give you a scattering amplitude. And not surprisingly, the scattering amplitudes will turn out to be p-wave. Now, the most general p-wave scattering amplitude is known to have the following form. It has the form p-square divided by some function of p-square minus ip-cube. But this guy is a Taylor expandable function, so this form is proven in textbooks such as Landau and Lefschetz. So let me emphasize here, this is a scattering amplitude with the angular momentum 1. So all the information about scattering is encoded in this function. Now g is a bad notation here because I'm already using g for the coupling constant. Let me call it f. And now f of p square, in the case of p wave scattering, so at sufficiently low energy, we can Taylor expand it. And the first term of the expansion is called 1 over V, but V is called scattering volume, The reason it's called volume is because this guy has to have dimensions of volume. And then the next term we'll denote it as some k0 over 2 times p squared, where k0 has dimensions of inverse length or momentum or wave vector. And what is possible to do is to use this Hamiltonian to derive this and discover that indeed the scattering amplitude is given by this form, as it should, with scattering volume controlled entirely by epsilon naught. Let me write down just roughly how it depends on our epsilon naught. I'll even put pi's here. It will be epsilon naught minus lambda cube. Now, in practice, it's lambda cube times some number like 6 pi or something like that, but I'm not going to write it. So as epsilon naught is adjusted and it passes through some special value proportional to the lambda cube, some value which depends on the value of this cutoff, the scattering volume goes through infinity and this term goes through 0. And that's very similar to how scattering length in S-wave resonances also goes through infinity. So scattering volume plays the role of the scattering length. And now k naught has the form 4 lambda over pi. And here I'll just write things up to terms of the order of pi. So this guy, this k naught, its value depends on how big g square lambda is. So g square lambda actually is a dimensionless parameter, and I'll use it later in this talk. So if g square lambda is very small, then k naught goes as 1 over g square and becomes extremely large, and we call it weak resonances, and maybe I'll have time to explain why this is weak resonance. And if g square is very large, then these guys cancel, and then k naught is of the order of the cutoff lambda, inverse size of these molecules. So k naught is either inverse size of the molecule or larger, and k naught is also always negative, which is a signature of resonance scattering. And so you see that this scattering amplitude, as v is adjusted, has a pull, or almost exact pull, such that p squared over 2m is equal to 1 over v k naught, maybe 2, well, maybe m. So if, so remember k naught is negative, so if v is negative, that's, we have a resonance as p squared over 2m equals to this positive quantity, that's equivalent of the negative scattering length for the S wave, except in the case of P wave, the scattering amplitude has a pull up to this imaginary term IP cube. F of P square actually vanishes on this condition. So this guy plus that guy is equal to 0, which means that the scattering cross section plotted as a function of P square over 2m has a sharp peak at P square over 2m equals to this value. Again, that's for V negative. So that corresponds to the, resonance scattering as understood in particle physics. Here, maybe I'll take a chance to complain that in this business, people often say that we are on resonance, and what they mean by this is that the energy has been adjusted to zero. But in particle physics, when people say resonance, they mean something else. They mean particles scattering with some positive energy. They form a quasi-stationary state, which eventually decays. And that's what happens here. So when p squared over 2m is equal to this value, we're on resonance in the particle physics sense. A molecule, B mu, forms, lives for a while, then decays, and the scattering cross-section has a peak. Now, if V is positive, which, as you notice, corresponds to smaller epsilon naught, as well, decreasing epsilon naught, decreasing our detuning, then the pole of the scattering amplitude occurs at negative values of P squared over 2m. That means that a real molecule gets formed. So, indeed, what this guy is describing is some kind of a crossover from weak P-wave interactions, which result in forming a long-lived state, which eventually decays, to strong P-wave interactions, which bind two atoms into a P-wave molecule. Now, so with this understood, we can now try to see whether we can study many-body theory described by this Hamiltonian.
Can I ask you a question? So in the S-wave case, there is a regime which is universal. But just the only parameter is K Fermi times A, where A is the S scattering amplitude. So when actually it's possible to exclude the molecule at all?
Yes. So in that sense, in the P-wave case, there will be no such universal regime at all. Well, it depends on your point of view, what you call universal. But
universal, I mean when the ultraviolet behavior becomes irrelevant. The details of ultraviolet behavior becomes irrelevant. In the S-wave channel, the only quantity which comes from the ultraviolet physics is the S-scattering amplitude.
You can argue that here, ultraviolet behavior will also be irrelevant. For example, if G is sufficiently small, so this guy is lambda independent, lambda is the only ultraviolet physics here, then the only place where ultraviolet physics will enter is through lambda cube, but that happens in the S wave also. There's always renormalization of detuning. That detuning in the Hamiltonian gets replaced by a shifted detuning. And you call this difference by detuning. So you see, it's a matter of definition. The way you said it, no ultraviolet physics, I would say, yeah, no ultraviolet physics. But the question is how?
Volume of K0, whereas in S wave, there's just the scattering rate.
Exactly. So in that sense, if you really want to be universal, what you have to do here is.
Two parameters instead of just one.
Well, I guess it's all about what are our control parameters. Parameters, because in the S-wave resonance, if I work in the units K Fermi times A, then everything is universal. But if I want to describe everything in terms of the some position of the resonance in terms of, say, magnetic field, then of course this position will be non-universal. It will be coupled to the magnetic field. Maybe that's the role of your lab.
So the reason is because there's only one parameter in S-wave. So let me write down S-wave scattering amplitude here. So the S-wave scattering amplitude has the form minus 1 over A plus perhaps terms P squared, P to the fourth power, and minus IP. So minus IP is fixed by unitarity in the same way how minus IP cubed here is fixed by unitarity. If you're working at sufficiently low momentum, these guys will always be less than IP. And you say, okay, so if I'm at sufficiently low momentum, which means sufficiently low Fermi energy in the S-wave case, I only have one parameter, which is this A. And if A happens to be infinity, then it's completely universal. And then we get this wonderful universal unitary physics. Now, in the P-wave, though, you see that because we have the IP cube here, we need to keep two terms.
When A is finite, A should not necessarily be infinity. Then there will be
universal in the sense of there's only one dimensionless parameter, ratio of A to the particle spacing.
I'm talking of the universality, but all ultraviolet physics comes in the form of just one parameter, A.
Here you have Kf times A as your dimensionless parameter, whereas over here you presumably have V times Kf cubed and K0 over Kf. So you have
two absolutely.
I'm not about the unitarity, I'm just about replacement of ultraviolet physics, but by just one number.
You need to have two numbers in this case. In that sense, it's non-universal, or maybe it's still universal. Maybe, but you need to have two numbers for the P-wave case.
Just more rich.
Okay, yeah. Maybe my favorite answer to this question is that S-wave BCS-BEC crossover was a very interesting phenomenon, and the most interest to it stemmed from the fact that there is a universal unitary point around, and then there's one parameter which describes how we move through this unitary point. These effects are absent in case of the P-wave, but fortunately we have other reasons why we want to study P-wave, which have nothing to do with that universality. It's a different phenomenon, namely the possibility of phase transitions and the fact that we might be able to get a topological phase are alternative and not less interesting, or I would even perhaps volunteer to say that maybe even more interesting than the unitary point of the S-wave BCS-BEC crossover. Although more interesting, it's very subjective. I perfectly understand that the S-wave BCS-BEC crossover is very interesting in its own right. So, so we now understand all these things. Now we'd like to study what happens with this Hamiltonian when we have a gas of these fermions. And the first thing we can do is we can write down mean field theory, which this two-channel model is well suited to. Now, when we're writing mean field theory, there's always a question whether it works or it doesn't work. And so here, this question deserves some study. One parameter which clearly describes interaction here is G. So somehow, if G is very small, clearly if it covers this all together, then mean field becomes exact. We can replace B by its average B. So the question is, how large is G? And then, of course, the question is, compared to what? So G here has dimensions of inverse square root of length. It might take some effort to work it out, but it is inverse square root of length. So G has to be combined with other things to form dimensionless parameter. And one very natural parameter is G square times, actually, I guess I was wrong, right? G square should have dimensions of length. Yes, the theory should be non-renormalizable in the field theory sense, which means G has negative dimensions, which means in terms of length, as opposed to momentum, it's positive powers of length.
I have a question about the near-field theory. So in would G, in principle, have a different symmetry of the gap? So suppose I'm
yeah, also in 3D.
So B, yeah, right. So B is essentially, like, I can think of B as BCS order parameter.
Right.
So in principle, it can be PX or PX psi PY. In this model, where do I put basically this symmetry and the mean field?
I haven't come to that, but it's the question is which order parameter wins. There will be several ways to condense B. You will condense B with different angular momentum, and depending on the angular momentum, you'll either get PX plus IPY or PX state. And I'm just coming to that, so maybe you'll see it in a second.
The dimension depends on the volume, depends on the dimensionality. You know, expression
has
G always
float on. Right. Well,
so this is scaling for three dimensions. Here.
This is scaling for three dimensions, right. G becomes dimensionless in 2D. In fact, some of this, if you listen to the talk by Subir Sajdev on our G approach to this Hamiltonian, it's all already contained in there, although he studied S-wave, not P-wave, so it changes some things. But so gamma here then becomes a dimensionless parameter. It's a ratio of the length scale defined by G square to the length, to the particle separation. Square root of Fermi energy is inverse particle separation. And so if this guy is large, then we're clearly in trouble. That means that there are strong fluctuations on the scale of Fermi energy, which will perhaps make mean field meaningless. And I really don't know what happens when gamma is large. But fortunately, as you can see, gamma depends on Fermi energy in a way that it decreases as Fermi energy is decreasing. So what it means is that in these experiments, it's very hard for them to increase density, but it's very easy for them to decrease density. You just evaporate more particles, and the density becomes lower. The problem is when you increase density, and then all sorts of bad processes start happening, and things might collapse. So we think that in the current experiments, this is very well satisfied. And so that might argue for the mean field applied to this Hamiltonian to work very well. Now, we call this parameter gamma the criterion for whether the resonance is wide or narrow compared to the particle separation. Now, not everybody is using these notations. Unfortunately, this word wide and narrow also has a meaning in atomic physics, and as we've discovered, can lead to confusion. Here, it's the interaction term, which has to do with, well, if you work it out, it has to do with the width of the resonance, because it tells you how long-lived B particles will be if they propagate, if they have positive binding energy, they propagate in space. Eventually, they'll decay into A through G, and so if G is very small, then the probability of this process is small, and the width of the B level will be narrow, and that's why, and this effectively compares that width to the energy scale set by Fermi energy, and so we think that this will be much less than one, and so we call this resonance as narrow, and narrow means mean field works.
Now I'm confused. So in a low density limit, so it should be correspond to a strong coupling region for molecules, right? As Fermi energy is smaller than the interaction compared to kinetic.
Well, so in the P wave, things are reversed. And that's a good thing about P wave. So because G square, well, because of this P mu. So in the S wave case, you're absolutely right. The lower the density, the stronger interaction. And the P wave is reversed. Partially is because, from the point of view of Subir Sajdev from modulation group analysis, we're above the upper critical dimension.
In a kinetic energy system, almost free, right? Interaction is a small division.
Well, but notice that interactions also become stronger as momentum grows. So they start interacting more. Okay, but it turns out there is also a second parameter which enters. Namely, as I said a few times, the theory is non-renormalizable, which means it suffers from ultraviolet divergences. Interactions grow very quickly with momentum. And some of these can appear, and they can also destabilize at least the naive mean field analysis. And these are controlled by the parameter, which is a really bad notation. But for historical reason, because we didn't appreciate the meaning of this parameter when we wrote the first paper, we called it C2. It was one of several parameters we had. The rest of them are completely irrelevant. This one is very important. And it's comparison of the scale set by G square and the cutoff scale, G square lambda. And so if this guy is large, what happens is that there could be virtual high momentum processes which might destabilize mean field, but in a way which is somewhat more controllable than what would have happened if gamma was large, because these are all few body processes. So at large momentum such as lambda, there is going to be no real particle, only virtual particle can move there. What it means is that large C2 effectively means that various coupling constants get renormalized. Like, for example, this V and K naught, you might not be, V and K naught, you've just computed, so you can trust them. But, for example, higher interactions between molecules, for example, they might be renormalized in some non-trivial way. And if time permits, I'll also talk about what high C2 means. In current experiments, actually, C2 is high. And so as a result, the mean field results which I'll present will have to be taken with a grain of salt, and I'll actually explain in what sense they should be taken with a grain of salt. But still, mean field is a very good guiding principle on how to compute things, so let's just do mean field then, even though C2 is expected to be much larger than 1. In our original paper in 2005, we didn't fully appreciate the significance of C2. We thought that gamma is the right parameter, and so we said this resonance is narrow and mean field always works. Now we understand that you need to qualify this statement because C2 is large. And then we had confronted this problem that how do you call C2? So gamma, a smallness of gamma means resonance is narrow, but what if C2 is large? Does it mean that resonances are wide? But you already said they're narrow here. And so we decided to call large C2 strong resonances and small C2 weak resonances. And so even though gamma is much less than 1, C2 might actually be bigger than 1. By the way, lambda is always bigger than inverse particle separation, because if particles are such short distances that are smaller than the size of the molecule, the whole thing breaks up apart. So C2 could be larger than gamma, but not the other way around. Gamma cannot be larger than C2. And so after many discussions, we call this strong and weak resonances. I found atomic physics literature where those guys, they typically don't appreciate interparticle spacing. It doesn't exist for them because they study few body problems. And they do know about the existence of C2, and they call those guys wide and narrow. So in the end, it's a matter of taste. But you have to know that there are two parameters. One of them compares interaction to the interparticle spacing, and the other interactions with the ultraviolet cutoff or the size of the molecule. And one of them is typically small. The other could be large. Now, so with all this said, we can study the mean field theory. So mean field consists of taking B mu and replacing it by its expectation value, which is the classical field, which is also a vector, B mu, but it's Q independent. In other words, only zero component of Q should be replaced by this B mu. All other components of B should be removed altogether. So we stick it in here. We set Q to 0. And then the resulting Hamiltonian is quadratic. Its ground state energy can be found. And finally, the ground state energy should be minimized with respect to B mu to find what is called the gap equation. And it's also a good idea to do it in the ground canonical ensemble. So you'll have to subtract from this Hamiltonian a term counting number of particles, which looks like this. It's sum over P, AP dagger AP, plus twice sum over Q and mu, BQ mu dagger BQ mu.
Mu has two meanings in this.
Yes.
Cartesian direction and potential.
Yes.
You've used mu.
That's absolutely right. Well, it will be. I apologize for this. I agree. It is bad notation. One of them is a small mu, the other is a large mu. I could change notations. I could call it nu. What? Why wouldn't I call it nu? Just to avoid.
You will never mention chemical potential again.
I'll mention it a few times. You know what? Let me keep mu because I'm so used to calling this mu. chemical potential will appear, but it won't play a very important role. And I will always say this is chemical potential.
Okay. Excuse me, I have a question about the interaction again. So why is it proportional to the momentum? Shouldn't it be like P mu over P, like the direction of the momentum and the, well, basically, suppose I just talk about one channel model in which I have four Fermi interactions. So what you want to put in is just some attraction in the P wave channel. So basically, to integrate over with cosine phi and get minus, okay, negative.
Well,
shouldn't it be like just the direction of the momentum?
Okay, so this can actually be derived, and I guess the reason why it's proportional to P mu, or at least why it vanishes as P goes to zero, is because you are talking here about the overlap between plane waves which came in from two fermions and some rotating state which they're trying to form. Rotating state is phase changes by 2 pi as you go around. But the plane wave at very low momentum, they're almost constant in space. So suddenly you're projecting something which is constant in space onto something which is rotating. So you would think that the overlap will become worse and worse as those incoming things become flatter and flatter. But ultimately, this P mu is nothing but the Fourier transform of the spherical harmonic. And it's enough just to integrate over angles.
Right, but I also can do the same thing with just the direction of P mu, just P mu, or with the direction of P mu over P, and you will have no divergence. Suppose I go to higher orbital momentum or something. Does it mean that I will have more divergent interactions in some sense?
Well, sure.
Yeah, right.
Yes. So if you go to D wave, you will get P squared there and so on.
Yeah. Interactions are short range, so can't have a singularity at small P.
Yeah, right.
Yes. That's another way of saying it. Okay, so you replace this B mu by this big B mu, and as I said, minimize the ground state energy with respect to B mu, and you get the gap equation, which is very similar to the standard gap equation. Now here I'll be using mu twice, unfortunately, but we'll be clear which one is which. So you get this on the right-hand side, and on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, you'll get the standard integral, except because of the mu nu issues, you'll have something like this here, and then so this will be your gap equation. Mu, unfortunately, appears here as an index, and everywhere else it's the chemical potential. And now it's a matter of evaluating this integral. Now, clearly this integral is very badly divergent at large p, but that divergence does not depend on anything, it's just a number. That number can be absorbed into epsilon naught in such a way that it's precisely this combination, so it makes perfect sense. It's not epsilon naught which is physical, but epsilon naught minus this lambda cube term. So this guy will be cubically divergent. But there's also a sub-leading divergency, which is linear in p. And so that divergence should also be evaluated, and that one is physical. It has to be kept. You cannot just absorb it into something. So in evaluating this integral, you observe that there are two interesting areas of p which could contribute. One of them, which works only for positive mu, is when p squared over 2m is of the order of mu. The other is large p, because there is this subleading divergence which should be taken into account. Maybe I should remind you that as epsilon naught is varied, we go through from BCS to the BEC phase. If epsilon naught is positive, mu is roughly, well, it's relatively close to epsilon naught. Although if epsilon is very large, mu can never be bigger than Fermi energy. So that's, the signature of the BCS phase. When epsilon naught becomes large, mu is Fermi energy. And the smallness of G squared is compensated by large integral. And then as epsilon naught is becoming smaller, eventually mu starts tracing out epsilon naught. At some point becomes negative. That's what we call BEC phase in this business. So if mu is negative, then there's no Fermi energy here, and the Fermi energy area of P should be ignored. If mu is positive, then there's an area when P squared over 2m is of the order of mu, and that's where the integral is significantly large. That point should be taken into account. So, of course, I will not do the whole algebra here, but I'll write schematically the kind of free energy you get. So I'd like to obtain some sort of free energy such that variation of that free energy with respect to B mu gives us this equation. And so this free energy consists of the following terms. The first term is just this guy, and so it's epsilon naught minus 2 mu b mu star b mu. And the second term comes from evaluating this integral when p squared over 2 mu is of the order of mu. Only exists for positive mu's. For negative mu's, it doesn't exist. So there is a, just schematically, I'll put here some kind of theta function of mu, which emphasizes mu is greater than 0. Then there's a factor here, which is like mu to some power. Actually, in appropriate units, it's mu to the power of 3 halves, so that the guy nicely vanishes as mu goes to 0. And then there's a term, which is this, it's this typical BCS kind of term, logarithmic divergence when p squared over 2m hits mu. Because of the index, this vector index of b, that term is pretty complicated, so it's hard to write it in a general form, although possible, but it becomes very ugly. So I'll just write it very schematically. I'll write b mu as sum of two real vectors. So b mu is a complex vector, u mu and v mu are real. And then this term roughly looks like this. It's b mu star b mu, and then it has log of u plus v, where I also assume that u and v are orthogonal. Now, it's also possible to show that you can always choose them orthogonal. If they're not orthogonal, you can do some gauge transformation and make them orthogonal.
So u
and v, this is a complex vector, b mu, can be presented as a sum of two real vectors. This is it. Yeah, these are amplitudes of these vectors. And that's why it's kind of hard to write in terms of b mu, although not impossible. Know some square roots of some products of these b mu's if you write it in terms of b mu's. But this is just schematically how this looks. And of course, this guy is u square plus v square. And then finally, there's a term which comes from large momenta, which, not surprisingly, that term will be quartic in B's. It comes from trying to understand what happens when P's are large. So the highest divergence gets absorbed into epsilon naught. The next divergence will be proportional to this guy. You'll have to expand the square roots in powers of these. You'll get some product like P mu, P nu, P alpha, P beta. There will be three of these B's, but now I've integrated with respect to B. So the term will be quartic. It generally has a form of some kind of scattering length. And there are two terms here, b alpha star b alpha plus 1/2 square plus 1/2 b alpha square b alpha star square. So those of you guys who can do calculations very quickly will recognize 1/2 from the fact that you get here p mu, p nu, p alpha, p beta, and that gets replaced by three delta functions, but two of them are the same, and they give this term, and the other one gives this term. So for those who work with spinor condenses will recognize that what this guy is describing is that these molecules, they have angular momentum 1, so it's a spinor condensate in effect. And these guys have the bosons with angular momentum 1. They are controlled by two scattering lengths, as was emphasized by a number of people. And in this particular calculation, one of them is exactly half compared to the other one. So
the second term I should interpret as b alpha squared b beta star squared.
Yes, yes. That's what I meant to write. I repeated alpha twice. Okay, and so now you have to minimize this f with respect to b mu and find the ground state. And, well, that takes some work. The main conclusion here is the following. So if epsilon is sufficiently large and mu is also sufficiently large, then this guy will always beat this term. It's because in that case, to compensate for the largeness of this guy, this logarithm will have to be large, which means u and v will be small, and logarithm will be large. But then this means this quartic term will be incredibly small. This is something quadratic small times large log. This is quartic of that same small parameter. So this term, which we'll call BEC term, you know, it's clearly some kind of Gross-Pitayevsky kind of thing for B alpha, this thing. So this term will disappear. We're in the BEC regime for large mu, and everything is determined by minimizing this log and B mu with respect to B. And now, that calculation was already done, in fact, by Anderson and Morel in 1961. They didn't have this guy. because they wrote this gap equation and they only worried about p squared over 2m being of the order of mu. So they minimized this, and they've discovered that the minimum is given by u and v being equal in length and of course, orthogonal to each other. So let's say epsilon naught is positive. And in fact, to be precisely in that regime, you need to have epsilon naught larger than twice Fermi energy, so that mu is at Fermi energy and epsilon is larger. Then
sign's correct. Seems like if you made a u and v perpendicular, the logarithm is the number in the logarithm is actually bigger, less negative.
It's not, the logarithm is a subtle term. I don't know how to see how it works out without doing actual calculations. And actually, there's another term which I deliberately didn't write because it's too complicated, but it should also be taken into account. There's another term, u cube plus v cube divided by u plus v, the sum coefficient, which is like 2 or something, which should be combined with this guy together. It has the same dimensions as this guy. It's of the order of v squared.
Oh, okay.
And so, well, the analysis of these two guys actually do give you that u and v should be equal in length and orthogonal to each other. In fact, Anderson and Morel, remarkably, I did not see that analysis in their paper. I saw some kind of numerics, which is remarkable because in 1961, I would imagine it was hard to do, and why wouldn't they just minimize it? I didn't understand that, but we can minimize, and moreover, when those guys minimized, they compared what happens, they've taken the phase px plus ipy, which is u and v equal in size, and px phase, which is v zero and u is non-zero, and they computed the ratio of the energies and did it numerically, but from this algebra you can also do it, and you discover that the ratio of the energy is equal to e over 2, where e is the base of the natural logarithm, and their number was, if you read it of their paper, it was 1 point something, and it's indeed e over 2, but they never in their paper say that it's e over 2. So it's definitely correct. What we got in science is what Anderson and Morel got in 1961.
Logarithmic also appears in the S-wave. Is there any difference from the S-wave?
Well, B doesn't have structure. B doesn't have vector structure. Here, B is a vector, and the S-wave, B is just a complex of the parameter.
Why is this long term is important? It seems that whether what kind of phase is determined by the
it's actually the second term that's selecting that the U and V are perpendicular, not the first term.
Yes, the quartic term, not the quadratic term.
No, the U, the one he wrote in response.
Yeah, this term is important.
Which actually determines that U is perpendicular.
And the origin of this term is, if you vary this with respect to b mu, you'll just get the logarithm, which is this integral. But when you integrate, you get two terms. It's like when you integrate log x, you get x log x minus x. This is this minus x, only pretty complicated minus x in this case. Okay, but so the main message is that u is equal to v. And when u is equal to v, it means that b mu as a vector can be chosen to be 1i0, and a vector which is 1i0, well, it is what we call px plus ipy phase. It's because b mu p mu looks like px plus ipy. So the other competing phase would have been v being equal to 0 and u pointing in some direction. Then b mu would have been 1, 0, 0, and that would have been a px phase. But so that phase, when epsilon is positive, even according to Anderson, does not occur. But and presumably that's why A phase of helium 3 and A1 phase, it's called A phase because Anderson predicted it by studying spinless fermions. Although notice, the difference with the actual theory of helium 3 is that there is no spin of those fermions. So the helium 3 theory is more sophisticated than this work. But now we also have a situation when epsilon naught becomes smaller than 2EF or even negative. In this case, this guy becomes smaller and eventually vanishes. And then we need to look at this term. And now, quite remarkably, and that's even easier to see, this term also chooses px plus ipy phase. And that's because p b alpha star square b alpha, b beta square.
But in this regime, does that mean that the mean field doesn't work essentially and this expansion is not valid?
No, why not?
Because you don't allow, I can think of this at least on the BCS side as some kind of Ginzburg von der Weinsberg expansion to derive the quartic trauma basically needs some kind of square diagrams with four Green's functions and, mm-hmm. and the quartic.
Yes.
So in this, okay, this expansion was derived from something else, right? So it's not.
Well, so. So first of all, so it depends. If all of these parameters gamma and C2 are small, it means diagrams with where G is excessively inserted are prohibited, in which case it's a completely correct, nice mean field. There's no other effects but this mean field. Once one of these parameters becomes large, and I argue that only C2 realistically will become large, this will actually start renormalizing the coefficients of this expansion. It's still a good expansion, but that's not a good way of computing coefficients of this expansion. And that was a work which I've done with Jesper Levinson a while ago, which in particular derived that famous 0.6 in S-wave BCS-BEC crossover, where you see that mean field still works if you're in the BEC regime, but you have to think about these coefficients properly. Now, here it turns out it's a little bit more dangerous. It can make this A, here A is positive, of course, but it can make this A complex. And if A is complex, you're in trouble and mean field might be unstable. That could be one of the origins of the. Well, it's so it means that those guys will have lifetime. The reason is there will be non-elastic process involving these bees. Well,
so you get an imaginary free energy. Uh-huh. That's not.
Well, remember that it's an instability. Yes, there will be an instability which might be one of those things responsible for current observed instability in FP wave condensates. But that would be an effect of C2 being large, which is large. So at small C2 and small gamma, you don't have to worry about anything. This is a good expansion. Okay, so going back to which phase you'll get, it's B alpha star square. B beta square is U square minus V square square. And the other guy here is U square plus V square square. So clearly this guy wants U to be equal to V. It doesn't want V to be equal to zero. So you are, again, in the PX plus IPY phase.
U cross V square.
This? Well, yeah, so they are orthogonal to each other, U and V. So if you write B alpha, if you take square of this, you get this square minus this square, and the cross term vanishes. So you see now that PX, well, the phases are going to be PX plus IPY throughout, and you can now plot a diagram. So if you have this epsilon naught here, and if you plot temperature here, I didn't talk about temperature, but you can believe me, since it's BCS to BEC situation, that this is what happens. So here you have some kind of exponentially vanishing temperature. Here the temperature goes to a level which is of the order of Fermi energy. That's very high for the usual superconductor. Here you'll have a BCS phase. Here you have a BEC phase. And finally, there is going to be a phase transition between them. So this line, which is actually not epsilon, the line happens not at epsilon not being zero, but at mu being zero. And they're close to each other, but they're not exactly coinciding. And so that's where you will go through, well, it's not really a quantum phase transition. So you should talk about phase transition as you move along this axis and pass through this point, mu being equal to zero. But there will be a phase transition. And by the way, the reason why there's a phase transition is very simple. It was first pointed out probably by Valavik in the 80s that if you write down Bogoliubov-Dejean spectrum of these phases, it's given by p square over 2m minus mu square plus g square b square px square plus py square. And so if, or maybe px square if it was px, but in this case it's just px plus ipy. So as mu changes sign, we go from a phase where there are gapless excitations along z direction to the phase when there is no gapless excitation, which is gapped. So clearly somewhere in the middle there's a phase transition, and that's why BEC and BCS are distinct phases.
Is it a change of symmetry or just a change of Fermi surface number?
It's a change, you gap out the Fermi surface. You could call it,
symmetry change, it's just a loss of, it's an opening of a gap.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Without change of symmetry.
Yes. So in this case, there is, I think, Fermi point, if you want to, right? And then as you, in the BCS phase, as you go to the BEC phase, then you get a gapped phase. If mu is negative, then clearly this thing is gapped. Now,
the way you draw it, it looks like there's a phase transition line.
It's only a zero temperature.
Yeah, it's zero temperature phase transition.
It's not a symmetry breaking, so there's no distinction at
fine. Uh-huh. Yes. this was a vertical line. Maybe I should put mu equals zero. I don't know how to properly draw it. In our original paper in 2005, we also studied some additional atomic physics, which make this phase diagram more rich, also has mixtures of PX phase. This has to do with the fact that the molecules themselves prefer to have to be in the PX state as opposed to PX plus IPY. They don't like rotating because of the internal atomic structure, and so there will be a competition between many body effects and one body effect, which you can also take into account. But for practical purposes, first of all, I would say it's a second order effect. First, these guys need to create P-wave condensate and then maybe study this competition. Second, it is always possible to do experiments in such a way as to avoid this issue altogether and just have PX plus IPY. So for the purpose of this talk, I want to ignore these effects altogether that I discussed in the first two papers here. And so in that case, there's only PX plus IPY phase, and this is what will happen as you go from one phase to the other, from BCS to BEC. Another observation, by the way, which was made by Nick Reed, is that even if you're in two-dimension, so in two-dimension it sounds like that this spectrum was gapped both for positive mu and negative mu. You no longer have z-direction to have gap-like excitations when mu is positive. Nevertheless, BCS and BEC are two different phases, and there's again a phase transition between them, but that phase transition is topological. And in fact, that was probably actually also pointed out first by Volavik, although here I think the literature is kind of murky, so I never fully understood whether Volavik appreciated this point or only emphasized it after Nick Reed put it together in his 2000 paper with Dmitry Green. So even when we're in two dimension, we have a phase transition between two fully gapped phases, and one of them, the one which is a BCS in two dimension, is the quantum Hall state, the one which is topological and which has non-abelian excitations and might be used for quantum computing. The BEC phase is non-topological, and so between them there's going to be a phase transition. Okay, so I used up almost an hour, but...
Interesting happen at that phase transition point, some special critical point.
Well, my understanding is that as long as this mean field theory works, you understand fully this critical point. You know...
In two dimensions,
yes, so there's a topological invariant which changes its value as you go through this phase transition. This is the invariant which I think was first pointed out by Volavik. It's constructed of, as you study these BCS and BEC condensates, and if you introduce Bogolubov amplitudes UP and VP, which is not my U plus IV, but is a UP and VP, which I think we heard about here before, maybe in Glasman's talk. And so those UP and VP correspond to a spin, as Anderson pointed out. And now that spin can be thought of as a vector, and so that vector covers the two-dimensional plane fully if we're in the BCS phase, or doesn't cover it. In other words, the mapping between the two-dimensional plane onto the three-dimensional, or maybe, into a sphere, which is set by this vector, is a topologically non-trivial in the BCS phase and trivial in the BEC phase. And that presumably is the origin of the topological, origin of the topological nature of the BCS phase here, which I remind you also called Pfaffian state in the context of quantum Hall effect, and presumably is the origin of non-abelian statistics. And although I would say I have not seen a straightforward demonstration that the presence of that topological invariant leads to non-abelian statistics. Although there are some sketches of the calculation in the book by Volavik, which came out about 4 years ago, where he says that he can actually connect non-abelian statistics directly to the presence of that topological invariant. But here I think the jury is out whether what he has is a proof or it's just some kind of a interesting direction to look at.
How can that topological invariant change?
Well,
I guess it changed discontinuous.
It is a discontinuous change. So this
must be in some sense first order then.
Well,
in two dimensions.
So
in two dimensions a gap closes at the translation.
Gap where?
Well, if you look at it, yes. So.
Oh, a gap closes at k equals zero.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Just set mu equals zero there.
So yeah. In that sense, it's similar to three.
Mm-hmm. discontinuity occurs, well, you're somehow, you're pushing.
If you close a gap in mu equals zero, it's obvious that you can change things. So it can be continuous. It is.
Mm-hmm. So I think here what happens is that you're pushing a topological and trivial point to high and high momentum. I'm not actually sure. I haven't checked that.
Like
but
putting it through the origin.
And then eventually you flatten. Yeah. Okay, but, well.
So it is some special critical point. Is it interesting or it's sort of trivial?
Well, it's trivial. It's not interacting for
me. It's not interacting for me.
It's
okay. It's quite trivial.
That's it. I mean,
right,
that's
okay.
It, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say, actually, the beauty of that work by Nick Reed was that.
The superconductivity doesn't care. The whole thing is superconducting everywhere around it.
Yeah, so I think the beauty of the work of Nick Reed was that was the first time when a quantum Hall-like state was derived from a non-interacting Hamiltonian where you didn't have to make any approximation, just followed from it, unlike other quantum Hall literature. So just as I planned, I used up the whole hour to say this, but typically our talks do go a little bit over time. So if you don't mind, and you know, you guys are welcome to leave, as always. But I'll try to spend the remaining 10 to 15 minutes.
Chairman, I'll allow you.
Yeah. You'll allow me how much?
15 to 20 minutes.
15 to 20 minutes. Okay, thank you. So let me try to talk a little bit about the last work, which we've done in the very end. So I told you that experimentally there were attempts to realize SP wave condenses, and so far they don't work. The lifetime of these molecules is about 1 to 2 milliseconds. So we tried to understand why the lifetime is so short. And so one origin of short lifetime could be traced to the fact that C2 is large. So because C2 is large, this mean field theory, or at least this expansion, the coefficient of the expansion, are not completely reliable. In particular, this quartic theorem is actually interaction between two molecules, and it was derived in the Born approximation. One can show that for large C2, that doesn't work. And a particularly instructive calculation involved calculating scattering between an atom and a molecule.
So it's all within this Hamiltonian, right? So this decay process.
Yeah, so there's actually two sources of decay processes. One of them is in this Hamiltonian and the other isn't. And first I'll talk about the one which is in this Hamiltonian. The one which isn't is harder to study because you have to wave your hands because it's not in the Hamiltonian. This one you can...
Just like what it is.
A collapse of the molecules, but I'll come to that. Yes, first I'll tell you this in the next 5 minutes. No, it's worse. It's worse. Well, okay, let me, maybe you're right. Maybe I should explain this before I say anything else or write down any more equations on the blackboard. So one of the major problems with the systems is that these are real systems. These are not some abstract point particles interacting exactly like this Hamiltonian prescribes them. In particular, when two fermions approach each other, there are strong van der Waals forces which may bind them into a molecule with a body energy which is orders of magnitude bigger than anything in this Hamiltonian or the kind of Fermi energies or temperatures these guys are working with. And ultimately, it's because all of these systems at such low temperatures should be solids. They should not be gases in the first place. So they're trying to collapse. And a major issue here is how long does it take for these things to collapse? In fact, when people were working on the BEC condensates, there were predictions that they'll never work because this will only collapse. Turns out that's not exactly true. And same thing was with S-wave BCS-BEC condensates, which also could have been unstable, but they turned out to be stable. And that was explained very nicely in the work by Petrov, Salamon, and Shlyapnikov, the origin of this instability. So why wouldn't I just talk about this instability? So they pointed out that you have, let's say you have a molecule, and let's say it's a large molecule, so you're close to the crossover point, which is somehow the most interesting when temperature is already high. So a molecule flies with some typical size. Let me call the size of the molecule A. And another molecule flies by. And what can happen is that this guy, this atom, can somehow approach this molecule close enough. And then this molecule collapses into a tightly bound state whose body energy is very large. So let me write it here. Tightly bound states with the binding energy which is of the order of minus lambda squared over 2m. So lambda is that lambda, the cutoff I had in my problem. And the remaining energy will be given by this atom, which will fly away with enormous speed, you know, with the kinetic energy, which is far bigger than the Fermi energy of this system. And so if this thing starts happening, then experimentally what will be observed is that things will start disappearing. Now this atom, as it flies out, might actually do even more damage, and so eventually everything just blows up. Now, the question was, how quickly does this happen? And maybe it's worth to for me to present for you these estimates and then tell you what happens in case of the P wave. So I heard several talks by Shliapnikov and by Petrov where the results of these lifetime estimates were presented, but I've never seen the actual derivation. It is in their paper, but it's, well, they somehow always kept it private from others. And so during our work, well, Nigel actually understood as far, well, I hope that he understood exactly what the calculation was. At least we can reproduce the results. And so we now understand very well the origin of stability of the S wave, and perhaps also instability of P wave. So imagine that a molecule of the size A, which is large, you know, a molecule with the binding energy controlled by this parameter, approaches another molecule, and you'd like to ask the probability that this kind of process I've described will happen. So you describe this probability, well, you describe the rate at which it happens by some kind of a product of sigma Vn, where sigma is a cross-section of this process, V is the velocity, N is the density. And let's say that we are in some BCS-BEC regime where the size of the molecule is roughly the density. So the parameter A is both the size and the density. So A is size and also particle separation. For estimate purposes, it doesn't matter that they're different. So then I want to estimate sigma, and here I can use the following extremely hand-waving but well-working argument. So I have two objects of size A, they're colliding, the cross-section is A square. But of course they can also collide elastically, so I need to calculate the probability that they collapse during this process. So what I'll do is I'll find time during which they're colliding, I'll take A divided by the velocity, and then I multiply it by some kind of rate, which will tell me the probability that during the this collision, the collapse process will happen. And the rate is fully controlled by energy scale of the tightly bound states. So I will declare that this rate is h bar divided by m r e square. R e is the inverse cutoff of the size of these tightly bound molecules. And so finally, the last factor has to do with the probability that three atoms found themselves at a distance r e from each other. So once they're at a distance r e from each other, these kind of effects, strong interaction forces, kick in, and what happens here might happen. So let me call it P3 body. Let me just call it P3 body, and then I'll have to estimate it. And then I have to multiply it by V and by N. And now N is 1 over A cube. So this is very nice. Now V's cancel. Now I need to calculate P3 body. So P3 body can be calculated in the following way. If I know 3 body wave function, then I can just integrate it to up to RE and integrate it up to A and compute the ratio. And so here, well, I could use the fact that the 2 body wave function for a molecule goes as 1 over R e to the minus R over E over A. And so now 3 body wave function, well, the simplest guess would be that at least for R less than A, it's 1 over R12, R13, at least for these are distances between 1 and 2 and 1 and 3, so at least when all R's are less than A. But this ansatz is actually correct for bosons, but it's incorrect for fermions, because it violates Pauli principle. Somehow it makes wave function symmetric. So let me write here bosons. But in general, actually, psi 3 body can be written as some r, which is some kind of average of all these r's 1, 2, 1, 3, to some power, which I'll call gamma. And for fermions, it turns out to be a non-trivial number, which can only be computed numerically. So let me, for a second, just postulate the existence of gamma. then P3 body can be argued to be RE over A to the power of 6 plus 2 gamma. So where did that come from? 6 came from the fact that I'm in three-dimensional space. I have separation R12 and R13. I have integrated over these guys up to RE and up to A. And at bigger than A, wave functions just decays exponentially. So that gives me 6. But on top of it, I have this wave function, which means the probability goes as 2 gamma. So that's where I got this factor. So now, let me put all of these factors in. So I have H square over M RE square times RE over A to the power of 6 plus 2 gamma. I think everything else just cancels. And finally, let me rewrite it in the following more interesting form. MA square times RE over A to the power of 4 plus 2 gamma. So now things depend on whether I have bosons or fermions. So when I have bosons, it turns out this wave function is a very good wave function, although it's not actually exactly trivial. So you have particles strongly interacting close to resonance. There are three of those. And you're asking, how does their wave function behave when all three approach each other? Now, those of you who were here during Eric Braaten talk, who talked about Efimov physics, can actually just do add one more equation to the equations he wrote on the blackboard and obtain that gamma should be equal to minus 2, just like this wave function predicts. You can, I also encourage you to listen to his talk. It was very interesting because typically we working in condensed matter physics don't know much about Efimov physics. But so this gamma, nevertheless, is minus 2 for bosons. And as you can see, what happens is that for bosons, the rate does not depend on RE at all. It only depends on A. It's actually all H's. I'm talking about rate, not energy. But now remember, A is both the size and particle separation. So this guy is roughly Fermi energy. So you have a collapse which goes at the same rate as the Fermi energy. So you cannot talk about any kind of many body states. As soon as you have bosons close to Feshbach resonance, they just disappear. And that's the reason why bosons with Feshbach resonance are so well hard to do. And many of us who wrote papers on various interesting many body states with bosons and Feshbach resonances have to confront this problem that bosons have a very high decay rate into these deeply bound states. But now for fermion situation is a little bit more subtle because you can no longer write down this guy. You might argue that the right wave function is kind of like you try to expand it to make it anti-symmetric, and maybe you acquire two extra factors of R here. Now, in practice, it's a little bit less than two extra factors. So for fermions, this gamma was calculated numerically by Petrov, Salomon, and Shlepnikov, and gamma turns out to be roughly minus 0.22, but pretty close to zero, which would have been if you just multiplied this by R squared by saying that some anti-symmetry Pauli principle factor comes in. And then this estimate comes in, which is gamma is h bar over ma square times RE over A to the power of roughly 355, because this next digit, I think, is 5 or 7. So you get 355 here. Now, in practice, RE over A is something of the order of 500 to 1,000. So suddenly you take Fermi energy multiplied by this enormous factor. It's like 10 to the 9th power, maybe even more. So in practice, the Fermi energies in these systems are about 10 kilohertz. So you're talking about lifetimes which go into minutes or even more. Now, those which are observed are more like seconds when you have fermions. And I'm emphasizing S-wave fermions. And then, so we assume that that's because there is some numerical prefactor here of the order of 10 or maybe even 50, which makes it a little bit shorter. But one thing which Petrov and Salomon checked is that they looked at the decay rates as a function of A, and it gives you the right dependence on A. So that's what happens in the case of S wave. Now, what happens in the case of P wave? Well, here the situation is actually worse because you can check that the wave function two-body wave function for the P wave goes as 1 over R squared for R is much less than A. In this case, A, again, is the size of the molecule controlled by the binding energy. And what this implies is that if you compute the probability that a particle sits within a distance RE, that probability will be of the order of 1. Let me emphasize that the probability as a function of R diverges up to RE. Here there is some A, here there is some RE, and then I don't know what it does, lower, shorter than RE, that's where forces kick in, but the value here is 1 over RE to the fourth power of the probability where it saturates. And if you compute the weight of the wave function sitting here and the weight of the wave function sitting here, they'll be about equal, and most of this weight will be here, which means that the molecule is really not the size A, it's actually the size RE. So when two such objects of the size RE collides, well, what happens is, well, let's just quickly analyze this formula. This A cube will remain. You're right. Yes, this A cube will remain because this K cube came from the density. Everybody else gets replaced by RE. There's nothing else there. So the rate becomes H square over M A square, and we need to get this A cube, so it's going to be RE over A. And there's nothing else there.
What would that plot look like in the S-wave case?
In the S-wave case, it's actually the same, but the only difference is that this guy goes as 1 over R to the fourth power, which means it's divergent at small r's. In the other case, it goes as 1 over R square, which means it's actually divergent at large r's. And that's why in the S-wave case, the weight is dominated by this area, and there's almost nothing here. While in the P-wave, the weight is dominated by this area, and there's almost nothing there. Actually, it's more tight in the P-wave case. It's because P-wave has a centrifugal barrier. Things have to hide behind the centrifugal barrier, if you think about it. So you see that this gamma is actually not as fast as Fermi energy. This is Fermi energy. There's a factor of 500 to 1,000 sitting here. So maybe it gives us some room of wiggle, because we can say, well, there is still some sufficient lifetime. When you evaluate this thing, you get something like a tenth of a second. But now remember that this guy also overestimated lifetimes by a factor of about 50. So if you factor this in, you get numbers which are very close to what is observed experimentally. On top of it, if you look at the hybridization rate, the rate at which molecules convert into atom and back, it's of the same order as this. It has the same factor RE over A. And as a result, you start thinking, well, if there is some kind of equilibration time, it's at least of the order of this hybridization rate. And so these rays are of the same order, so presumably it will be hard to see anything, any kind of stability when, so for this PVF consensus, and that's probably what's going on here. By the way, I should say that many people were saying, yeah, IPwave should be unstable because these guys are tight. But actually, RE here plays double role. On the one hand, tighter means easier to collapse, but on the other hand, tighter means easier to miss each other. So the cross-section actually became smaller. You know, this A cube factor, just as you pointed out, got replaced by RE cube factor. But there were some RE's in the denominator, and they conspired to make that thing worse so that we ended up with only one power of RE here and not like 3.55 as it was in the S-wave case. But not, it's still, it's not as bad as bosons in 3D.
When you go to 2D,
you'll
get another power?
Yeah, so finally the question was about 2D. So if you go to 2D, then in two-dimensional space, psi 2-body of R goes as 1 over R. For small r's. So now you have a logarithmic divergence, and you can argue that the weight sitting here is logarithmically bigger than the weight sitting at the origin. So suddenly you go back to the situation when you have a relatively large molecules as opposed to 3D where molecules are small. But that by itself is not enough to predict what the lifetime is going to be, because when you make molecules large, it's also easier for them to scatter. So what you need to do is to compute to find this gamma, and that's what we're doing right now, but we have a conjecture that gamma is zero. And if gamma is zero, then you can go through the same argument here, and well, there will be some changes. A squared gets replaced by A here, we're in 2D, this is a cross section, 6 gets replaced by 4, and so if, and then there's a conjecture, which might be wrong, that gamma will go as h square over ma square over re over a square to go through the algebra. And if it's correct, then this clearly gives us room to obtain this condensate. Because it gives us another factor of 1,000. So again, it's not as good as S-wave fermions, but it's much better, I would say, than P-wave fermions. So there's also some interesting physics having to do here in the 3D P-wave case, which has to do with the formation of three-body states. So there's another channel of collapse, formation of Yefimov-like three-body states, which leads to the same cross-section as this. And unlike this estimate, it can be computed. So you can compute it, and you get the same rate as here. So that's another reason why I believe that this rate is correct in 3D.
Do P-wave FMO states form in 2D?
In principle, they can, but we don't know yet about what happens.
So that's why there's no FMO.
So in the first of all, the word Yefimov is
very poisonous.
So the word Yefimov is a danger. There are three body states in two dimensions.
For S-wave bosons?
Even for S-wave, I'm not.
Contact
interactions. Yes. So there's a paper. This was only studied about 2 years ago by Kagan and other authors. About five authors in that paper. And their result is that depending what you have, bosons, fermions, mixtures between bosons and fermions, you might have three and four body states. Now, I don't remember in which case how many states you get. And I also believe that they're not Yefimov. Yefimov states are very special states with specific, very peculiar properties. Those are just bound states. And so they have the whole table in their paper where which bound states you get is listed. So in principle, you can... I recommend to listen to the talk of Eric Bratton, which was here in late April. It's available online, and you can learn everything you need to know about the Yefimov states.
This right-hand reference you just mentioned, the five also co-authored the paper. These five also.
Uh huh. What about that paper?
The reference. The
reference. The Kagan's paper.
Kagan. Yeah. So the reference. So what would you like to know about this reference?
Which of the two Kagans?
I think it's the Young Kagan. The best way to find it is to look in my paper, where we refer to Kagan's paper. The first author on that paper, if you can remember, is Brodsky, B-R-O-D-S-K-Y. And then Kagan is one of, and I think it's M. Kagan, who is one of the other authors. And so these guys, what they do is they derive this famous 0.6 result, but they also study two-dimensional S-wave interactions and derive various possibilities for various bound states in two dimension.
These people are in the archive?
It's in the archive and it's published in Jet Letters in the fall of 2005, I think.
Is the interaction between the L equal to 1 pairs that we form ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic or just way too small to be important?
L equals 1.
You're basically forming molecules that are internal endomagnetic ones. So think of that as spin. As you said, it's like a spin of condensate. So is that ferromagnetic condensate or anti-ferromagnetic condensate?
Well, my first reaction is that it's ferromagnetic because I told you it's Px plus Ipy, which means all molecules want to rotate in the same direction and point upwards. So I interpret this as a ferromagnetic interaction. So the I think it's called polar phase. Px phase is suppressed. So you're trying to maximize the angular momentum. You have to explain to me why it's not the same.
In principle, it was there in his Landau theory, right?
You just have to interpret what I wrote.
They have definite coefficients.
Right, they have definite coefficients.
So there are two...
Yeah, I think you're right, the gradient term might be different.
Look, so you have two scattering lengths of L equals 1 particles, two interaction terms, both of them are positive. So from here, you should be able to deduce whether it's ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic. But I know that if you look at it, tells you that the angular momentum of the point is in direction.
Both of them could be positive, and it could still be either. I mean, it's a difference between the two of them to determine whether it's ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic. Right? I'm saying that.
I have to understand it. Because to me, it sounds ferromagnetic.
The phase is ferromagnetic.
Or just another one. That's the one that breaks T. And you always find a T breaking phase. You never get.
Yeah, you always find T breaking phase. And that's why in two dimensions, this will be the Pfaffian phase.
If you want to think in terms of order parameters, right, the spin is something like imaginary part of E cross B star,
yeah,
which is non-zero for these.
So in this system, why the polar phase is stable?
Stable in the sense...
I mean, your paper, you wrote that actually PX plus RPY in this system is not as stable as PX.
No, we wrote that it's stable, but in addition, we also studied effects which were, well, they give you richer physics, but they are, in my opinion, they are more subtle. Actually, if Leo was given this talk, he would probably want to emphasize these effects. I think that the fact that you get PX plus IPY is more important than these effects, but it's a matter of taste. So additional effects has to do with the fact that when molecules form, due to, for atomic physics reasons, they actually don't want to be in the angular momentum plus one state. They want to be in the angular momentum zero state. So they want the projection of the angular momentum on a chosen axis to be zero. That has to do with magnetic dipole interactions of the outer electrons in this diatomic molecule. Yes, it's a magnetic field because the system sits in some external magnetic field which controls Fischbach resonances. So it's a projection on that axis.
It necessarily is a magnetic field because you're tuning to a Fischbach resonance.
Uh-huh. So now this effect starts competing with many body effects which want you to drive PX plus IPY. Now things now depend on how strong these effects are. If they're very weak, you can ignore them. And then, as they become stronger, you get some on this diagram. You get a sliver of PX plus IPY state. I mean, PX state, which becomes stronger, and eventually, when these effects are strong, it all becomes PX. But then, when these effects are even stronger, it's then the splitting, the energy splitting between PX molecules and PX plus IPY molecule becomes so large, much bigger than Fermi energy. We can forget about one of these species of molecules and just tune in resonance with the other. And then you go back to this phase diagram. Or if you wish, you can actually get PX phase diagram by tuning to the other component. But what is important, and what I want to emphasize, that many body effects drive you to be PX plus IPY, so there will be no... If you make sure that your atomic physics does not spoil it, you will get PX plus IPY state. And it's not hard to make sure that your atomic physics doesn't spoil it. So this was what was in our 2005 paper. And also there was another paper a little bit later than us by Yip and his collaborators who also studied these effects of splitting, and they got the same phase diagram. Even actually, to be honest, we made a slight mistake in one of the possible phases, which then corrected several months later. They corrected, and we indicated this in our paper when it was eventually published.
So compare this with the helium-3, so is there, what's the major difference between the PV collider with the helium-3 system?
Well, helium-3 has more phases because it has spin. So these fermions are not spinless, while here they are spinless. So once you get spin, first of all, you have a strong desire to form a B phase, which is kind of the most simple of them all and which doesn't have any gapless excitations. Well, what are the advantages? I mean, the advantage is that it already exists in nature, while these phases were not obtained yet for reasons I've explained. A disadvantage is that if you are worried about topological phase, in helium-3 it's hard to achieve. It has to be A1 phase or perhaps A phase. There are some suggestions how to use A phase. And second, it's hard to do any experiments on helium-3 if you want to study this topological phase. Not clear what you will do with your helium to study it. While in this system, if you do get this topological phase, there were already many suggestions in the literature about what you will do to study these non-abelian excitations. And in particular, Nigel Cooper and Adi Stern have a paper where they've calculated the RF absorption signature of existence of the non-abelian states, which could in principle be observed if two-dimensional P-wave, PX plus IPY excitations or condensate will be obtained. So there it's clear what you do once this is done, because they have these tools to measure things.
Okay, thank you.
question. You were saying that the molecule is always tight, but if we are at the very threshold of the molecule formation, just naively I would expect, just by the uncertainty principle, that the dimer should be loose enough. So the size should be big enough, and maybe you can use it as a small parameter to suppress the close approach, because the fermions are maybe to suppress the decay.
You see, I think the problem here is that you have the centrifugal barrier, which traps state inside, and even if you're above resonance, there is actually a long-lived state hiding behind this centrifugal barrier. So from the point of view of that state, if centrifugal barrier was infinity, all that happens that goes up and down, it doesn't care about the point where it goes through zero. The only difference is that if it has positive energy, it has some escape time. But that escape time becomes smaller and smaller as energy goes to zero. In fact, you can show that as the energy of this long-lived positive energy state is tuned to zero, as a consequence of the scattering amplitude, which I've already erased, its lifetime will go to zero as the energy to the power of 3/2. Not the lifetime, but the rate. The lifetime will diverge as 1/3, which means the smaller is the energy of this guy, the more well-defined it becomes. So by the time its energy is zero, it's a nicely well-defined bound state hiding behind the centrifugal barrier. So it's all in 3D. So 2D somehow it's not. You get these logarithms, which is the origin of the hope why it might work in 2D.
Sorry, Victor, I have another question about this decay rate gamma. So the parameter which controls this gamma, is it connected with the parameter which controls the applicability of your mean field approach? Is this similar parameter? Is something completely different?
So parameter which controls...
Well, I mean, you want this gamma to be large, right? So for the stability...
Actually, small. I want it to be small.
Yeah. So... And also, there is a parameter which in the mean field, in the Hamiltonian, which controls the applicability of the mean field theory. So are these parameters related in any way? No?
Well, so we had hope that... So let me put it like this. So one thing which we understand now is that if that parameter C2 I wrote, if it's large, then I can derive gamma, and this is what gamma will be. I can derive it from that Hamiltonian. So that's one thing. Now, if parameter C2 is small, then in principle I can no longer derive it from that Hamiltonian, because I now have to consider this collapse process, which is not part of this Hamiltonian. While if C2 was large, then there was additional processes which are in this Hamiltonian, which lead to the same rate. So we can also go through the motion, and what we obtain is that gamma becomes even less. Let me think. Actually, gamma becomes less, so you would think it's good, but simultaneously interactions become weaker. And actually, interactions become weaker faster than gamma becomes less. So situation gets worse as coupling becomes weaker. And that's why, in the end, we decided that trying to have G small is not a good idea either. It's not going to help. It's only going to make situations worse. On top of it, G squared times the cutoff, which is what I call C2, it's a property of a particular resonance. You cannot control it by changing your experiment. And in current experiments, I believe that the C2 is of the order of 10. It's a relatively large parameter. You cannot say that it's much smaller than 1. So this is what happens.
Thank Victor one more time. As chairman, I'll leave.